the point is to optimize for novelty and creativity and variance. The growth of knowledge is basically the growth of capacity to solve problems. The way to destroy the creation of knowledge is to operate with coercion. People are not specific enough and honest with themselves enough about the problem that they're trying to solve. When I talk to people about why they're bummed out at work, it's ultimately because they feel like they could die and be replaced the next day. They are an interchangeable part in a machine.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Chris Turner. Chris is the founder and CEO of Moonrise, a co-learning space for homeschoolers and creative kids. We talk about the public education system, homeschooling, taking kids seriously, the internet as curriculum, skills for navigating the future, education startups, technology and design, and more. Please enjoy. What is the current objective of the traditional education system versus, in your opinion, what should it be?
Sure. That's a great question. So, you know, I think the education system is pretty broad, but most people, when they say the education system, they mean the public education system. So I'll start from that perspective and kind of work down. So I think the objective of the public education system is to kind of win the game of measured learning between the United States and other places, essentially, right? So learning, I think a lot of people think it's about, you know, mechanization of the workforce and stuff like that. And certainly there's a history there. But I think, you know, if you get at the state level, if you get at the country level, I think these are people with mostly good intentions. And then just, you know, they know bureaucracy, they know governments. So, you know, they very rarely know innovation and, you know, like the inner workings of change. So things move very slowly for them. And the measuring stick is other countries, essentially, or other states, right? So at the state level, Georgia wants to do better at test scores than South Carolina. At the country level, the United States wants to do better at learning than Denmark, right? I think it does a pretty poor job of that. So I think the U.S. is a bit anti-competitive compared to some other countries in the sense that they, if they really were driven by these things, they would do more experiments. But given its stature in the world and, you know, the fact that it has, you know, a lead in terms of, you know, economics and stuff like that, I think they are less inclined to, like, really strive for that objective. And they mostly just want to, like, you know, keep the engine running at this point. And they're, you know, frankly, losing their lead in a lot of ways in that regard. So I think the goal of the country is to have some measurement that they can point to that says, continue to elect me. Look, things are this way. I think we will start to see more experimentation because of that loss of the lead, right? Like the citizens are starting to get upset and we're seeing things like ESAs propagate across the country. I think that's one of the reasons why politicians are playing along is their citizens are getting upset.
And then what would you say, in your opinion, should be the aims of education or the educational system at large?
So it's tricky because, you know, again, at the country level, you actually want some degree of bureaucracy. Like, in some sense, like you want the people running the country to be more conservative than the entrepreneurs. So the point is to not mess things up, really, as a government, right? That's kind of how it's set up. It used to be set up in a much more revolutionary way, and I think we can certainly, like, inch towards it, right? So, you know, if you're saying, like, what should the goal of the public education system, this almost begs the question of, like, should public education still exist at all, right?
Yeah, so, to move higher in the stack, it's a good question.
Right. So assuming that it should exist, then I think that starts with the question of, what should the aim be, right? Which is your question about objectives. This is how I answer questions, by the way. Like, there's no, like, simple answer that there's just, like, one thing that you can point to, right? Even the idea of objectives themselves should be questioned. There's a guy, Kenneth Stanley, who wrote this book called Why Greatness Cannot Be Planned. And his thesis is that objectives as a whole are kind of the wrong way to analyze something like this. Because if you're talking about a human mind, like, the point is to optimize for novelty and creativity and variance, right? As opposed to some mechanized system that aims for something, right? And the things that you would normally want to aim for, like creativity and problem solving, those things cannot be measured, right? So if the government is to have a public education system, there are certain things that I think are a little bit more objective that have nothing to do with, like, quote unquote, learning objectives. One of the oddest things to me is that this current system doesn't optimize at all for well-being. And those are actually very easy targets to hit, right? So you can look at something like a classroom and you can say, should a classroom have more cinder blocks or should it have more windows with natural light? Should it have hard plastic chairs or should things be made out of wood, right? And oddly enough, these are almost entirely absent from most public education considerations because everybody is so focused on the objective of grades, right? So if these people, these kids are to be kind of held captive against their will, they should at least be taken care of and the childcare function should be performed better than it currently is. Outside of that, I don't necessarily agree that it should exist at all. But if it does exist, then I think they should at least make kids have a better time while they're being held there against their will.
If it wasn't to exist, if we just if the public education system dissipated overnight, what would you? And this is kind of a leading question because I think this dovetails nicely into what Moonrise is doing.
Yeah,
but what would you think would take its place? I think the operative part here is at scale.
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of the philosopher Karl Popper, and Popper was an advocate of institutions because they are kind of like the result of lots and lots of incremental changes. So people that say, let's throw out the whole thing and start over, I think are missing that aspect of the philosophy. So when I say it shouldn't exist, that doesn't mean if I became president, I would just like turn it off overnight, right? What you want to do is kind of like wind it back and start thinking of ways to exit the dependency on that system, right? Give people other options. The first thing I think that should exist is what is already happening. ESAs are a fantastic innovation to take the public funding that's already there and allocate it in a different way that gives parents choice in the matter, right? Ideally, you'd give kids more choice, right? But giving parents choice is at least a step over not giving parents choice. So I think that's great. Beyond that, what I think should take its place is, this is why it's something of a lead into Moonrise. Like if I thought it should be something other than Moonrise, then I would work on that instead. I think the bottleneck to fixing the whole thing is parents still need to work and kids still need a place to learn and make friends that's not their house, right? So people that are advocating for things like black and white home, like homeschool or school, right? Those are the two kind of currently accepted modes of learning. People that advocate for one or the other of those as being the end state of education, it's a bit like saying you're only going to work as a freelancer from your house or you're going to go work full time at an office.
Right.
And, you know, if you look around in the world, you see people working in coffee shops and co-working spaces, and they have, you know, flexibility to kind of choose the place that they want to work out of. That's the future that I see us building with Moonrise. And the idea of work is very similar to the idea of learning. Like learning is basically the work of children. The way that they are learning is radically changing too. Like they're learning online, they're learning with AI tutors, but there's still a lot of things that are needed in physical reality. And that's why I think spaces are still a fundamental building block. So if I could snap my fingers and move anybody instantly to a new system, if I had to do that and not in an incremental way, it would look like Moonrise because everything else, including micro schools, is still a version of a curriculum-led, mostly full-time school. And I just think that's, from first principles, the wrong way of going about it, given what we know about information theory and a lot of other stuff. We can talk about curriculum or any other way you want to go. There's so many rabbit holes we could go down.
Yeah, I wanted to dig into that actually more, which you just ended with. You've said elsewhere that you think starting with the idea of a school when attempting to reimagine learning is a bad place to start. It's flawed from the get-go. You have to go all the way back to the top of kind of the assumption stack, as I mentioned earlier, operating from first principles. Why do you think we just have to tear everything down? Why is there not like an existing, and maybe I'm over dramatizing this, maybe you do think there is a philosophy or conception. I mean, you still are using physical spaces. That's a concept. Yeah. But what is the place in the stack where you chose to start and why?
Sure. I think the deepest theory of Moonrise is that kids are human beings, and you know, human beings are universal explainers. We create knowledge in the same way, no matter what age we are. Obviously, adults have a leg up for a lot of reasons in their capacity to create knowledge, but the way in which that is done is identical to the way an infant or an infant creates knowledge. And oddly enough, the way to destroy the creation of knowledge is to operate with coercion. So you can look at history, kind of all the way leading up until the Enlightenment, and it's a story of the a long, long time of coercion and bad environments that lack knowledge and creative capacity, right? The second that you have the Enlightenment, and by the Enlightenment, I mean kind of like a broad set of values where people value novelty and creativity and freedom of expression, capitalism, democracy. I kind of chunk those all together as the Enlightenment, you know, progressive values, right? The second that those things into the picture, humanity just explodes. Like population growth goes nuts. We get all kinds of like just lovely inventions that make life better. And those are all in existence because we got rid of, increasingly like got rid of coercion, right? And nobody is on a faster track of learning and progress than children in their developmental years. But those are the most coerced years of anyone's life, is in those periods where they are learning, right? When you put somebody in a school, the reason why that's the wrong place to start is because schools are almost unanimously a coerced environment. So children are not given the choice whether to be there or not. Children aren't given the choice in what they learn. That's why curriculum, I think, is wrong on first principles. And we can go deeper into that if you want. And so coupled with this, you also have the internet, which gives any one child the capacity for learning and information that no one prior to like 1970 ever had, no matter how rich you are. So my five-year-old has access to more knowledge than the president of the United States in 1965, right? But we still think of school as a information conveyance vehicle, right? Mm. And it's really, really radically slow compared to the internet, right? And so if you couple all those things together, that's what I mean, is that you just fundamentally have to like say, okay, like if school never existed and somebody invented the idea that kids should be learning at some accelerated rate today, would you build school again or would you build something else? I think it'd be crazy to build school in this environment. Like, I just don't think it would ever happen that we would build it that way again. But since we're kind of mimetic creatures and we get tied into what is already existing, most people that work in education are just rebuilding different versions of the same thing that already exists.
One form of this coercion or manifestation of it is, fundamentally the idea of compulsory education is that it's forced and we're trying to get students to do it. There was a quote I pulled elsewhere where you said the most fundamental realization is that kids are human, as you mentioned earlier, which means they're creative learning machines who resist being controlled. So to your point, that foundational belief that you can entice somebody to do something which they don't want to do, particularly as it pertains to learning, is flawed. And yet there's still this existing environment and system that you have to operate in. Even when you're doing homeschooling, there's still state regulations, kind of certain benchmarks to learning that you have to meet. How do you, through Moonrise, make learning not feel mandatory while still reaching those objectives? How do you imbue it with the freedom and independence and autonomy that it should have?
Yeah, so one way is that Moonrise, I think the fundamental difference between Moonrise and a school is that we don't have a curriculum. So we have spaces, we have learning guides, we have lots of tools and books. We even have courses, clubs, field trips, all that sort of thing. The difference is that there's no such thing as saying this is how every kid learns at Moonrise, right? Like, this is our system to make sure that a kid learns and achieves some outcomes, right? Once you do that, everything becomes voluntary at Moonrise. So, you know, if a riser, that's what we call our kids there, if they want to learn, if they want to take a course on art history, which is what we had yesterday, if they show up for the course and it's boring, they can just walk away and make a podcast or read a book or go make something in the makerspace, right? This turns the idea of learning into something enjoyable, which it is. We all as adults have the experience of enjoying learning something. And we all had the experience of being in school and feeling like learning was not an enjoyable thing, right? So I think the number one thing is that you can make it voluntary, and that makes it more powerful. And then what the task becomes is variants of learning opportunities, right? So exposure to information, new knowledge, new projects, that sort of thing. The more that we can give them to possibly work on and choose between, the more they will be able to kind of enter the search space and figure out what lights their world on fire. But oddly enough, again, like most people, I mean, outside of their own interests, don't encounter the idea of podcasting until they want to, right? Like,
right.
Fortunately, it's permissionless, but there's no such thing as like, hey, let's introduce, you know, every 8-year-old to the world of podcasting, right? Roundabout way of answering your question. Hopefully I kind of answered it, but I think it's mostly about making things voluntary and exposing them to a lot of different things.
I think most adults would hear this, and while appreciating the sentiment that kids are capable and will choose learning when given this kind of open and flexible, autonomous environment, it gives them a little bit of pause where it's like, we believe in kids, but maybe not that much. Let's add a little more structure to it.
Sure.
How and why would you push back on that? And maybe anecdotally, what have you seen with learners that gives you confidence that given enough rope, they will trend towards learning and doing these things on their own time, even if it takes a little bit longer than we would mandate within the current system?
Sure. I mean, one of the points is that my beliefs about education are also not forced on parents. So we have homeschoolers at Moonrise who don't agree with everything that I'm saying and who do have their kids come to Moonrise, and they want their kids while they're there to do some curriculum that they're working on at home, right? So I'm not saying that we force our values on anybody. That's just like my beliefs as a founder, and it's an open space. Now, the adults know that we're not going to force their kids to do their curriculum, right? Just like when you go to work at a coffee shop, the barista is not asking you if you got your work done while you're there, right? But I just wanted to make that point that like we don't force our values on anybody. So what would I say to adults who believe that, you know, learning is slower or that kids won't actually do it if given freedom? I think most people like intuitively grasp that they have been in lots of various classes through school that they remember virtually nothing about in terms of the information they actually quote unquote learned, right? So one of the biggest like magic tricks of the current education system is that it creates the impression of learning, but does not actually create learning. So when you get an A on a test, or when your child gets an A on the test, right, you feel as a parent like they understand this information, right? What they've actually just done is they've won a little video game in this short period of time where they consumed and memorized some information such that they could win the game. And the second that game is over, that information is lost because it has no more context, right? Like the growth of knowledge is basically the growth of capacity to solve problems. And so when you don't have problems where you use the information in your life, you do have some memory, like some of it is there, and some people have great memories and some people don't. But, you know, the idea of learning is almost entirely in school based on memory and not on problem solving, right? So it's just a game that they're playing. So you know, in a controlled environment, you're basically like playing that game if they don't want to play with you because they don't care about solving that problem, right? So the game that we try to play at Moonrise is trying to figure out what we can do to make things meaningful problems to solve for them, right? Mm-hmm. If we do an art history class, it's done within the question of like, how does this become a meaningful problem for them to solve? Right now we're doing a Moonrise Ventures experiment where we're starting different businesses with our risers. Awesome. So the one today that we're working on is they come up with the ideas, they market them, they build them. It's basically from the ground up with our facilitation. Right now they're doing an escape room for Halloween. So the risers are getting together and they're, you know, building all the ghosts and stuff that are going to hang from the ceiling. They're planning out like, cool. How the escape room rules will work. That's a meaningful problem that they get really excited about. And along the way, they're learning about profits and marketing and construction and positioning and stuff like that. We're not calling it any of those things. We don't say, here's the marketing class, right? We say, here's the escape room, right, that you invented. Come and work on it. And they're picking up these things along the way, just like adults do when we work on this, right? Like, I didn't take any class on education theory, but I've had a lot of meaningful problems to solve within that, right?
Right.
So I think you can still have structure within the context of meaningful problems to solve that's not called a specific curriculum.
Is there any difference, if I had to summarize your orientation towards education, it sounds like you are opinionated about being unopinionated, or you're opinionated about allowing for others to have an opinion about it. And yet I imagine you're maybe a little bit more opinionated about your children's particular education or the philosophy you apply to it. Is that the case? Is there a little more structure in terms of how you do education with your children? And if so, what is that? Or is this the like one for one, the exact same mindset and philosophy you apply to your children?
Yeah. So real quick to touch on your first point, the way that I think about it is that if you're running a school and you're deciding which school is the best, either if you're the person running it or if you're a parent considering one, it's a bit like saying, like, what's the best monarchy, right? Like, which kingdom should I live in, right? And there have only been, let's pretend this is like 1765 or something like that, right? Like, there have only been monarchies, right? And so, like, your entire frame of mind is about monarchies and kings and who should rule and that sort of thing, right? And Moonrise is basically an experiment in democracy where, like, my opinion is, like you said, it's that I'm opinionated about being unopinionated. What we're really allowing for is the experimentation within a set of rules. So it's not anarchy. Like, there are rules that govern the way that Moonrise works. But there's no, like, single ruler and dictator of Moonrise where we say this is how everybody learns. So tying that into how I raise my kids, there are really just a couple like grounding things. One is that, and I think this is consistent with Moonrise, everything is always grounded in explanation. So there's never a time where we do something as a family where they don't understand why we're doing something. And so I'll give you an example. Like, just like a lot of parents, I really want both of my kids to learn how to read and to enjoy reading. So my son is reading great. He's 8 right now. Like, we don't have a reading problem with him anymore. He's, you know, going through, if anything, he's going too many books. My daughter is 5, and right now she doesn't really want to read, right? And so one of the reasons why I think reading is important is because it unlocks all the other stuff that we need along the journey, right? So reading is the one thing where if I'm on the verge of alienating any principles, it's for reading, right? And so when there's a conflict there, there's always a discussion where I sit down with her and I say, okay, like, first of all, we homeschool. Do you know what that means? And do you know what your day would be like if we didn't homeschool? And I'll walk her through what a day at school looks like. I'll be like, okay, so we do reading for 15 to 30 minutes a day, right? Like, do you know how much time you spend in school in a day and that you go to these classes and that you're told where to sit and that sort of thing? Like, does that sound better or worse than homeschool, right? Usually she doesn't, they doesn't think it sounds. I try not to lead her too much. I'm straight with her about it.
That's where I wanted to ask if you if there's bias in a way that you're trying to lead her down a particular path. If she said, I want to go to school, would you let her go to school?
If she said she wanted to go to school, then yes, I believe in my theories, in my principles, let her do that, right? Right now, she doesn't want to, because even sitting down for 30 minutes a day for something that we try to make really enjoyable is not something she always wants to do, right? So, you know, I think it's fair to say that if she went to school, there would be more of that, not less than that, right?
Yeah.
I suppose there's alternative.
You're consistent then.
Yeah. So I explain that, and then, you know, pretty quickly it's like, okay, like, these things are important to us as a family. Like, I think your question where this all started was, you know, there's like state mandates and that sort of thing. Maybe we got into that already. So, you know, there's a fact of the matter that, like, she has a mother too, and her mother's a little bit more traditionally minded in the sense of education, and we're a family, not a dictatorship. So all those things get thrown into the explanation pile, and we say, okay, given those things, like, what do you want to do? And the answer is always like, okay, cool, let's read, right? Like, it's not let's read because I really want to do that. Just like when I do taxes, I'm not like, yeah, let's go do taxes. I really want to run a business, and I really want to not go to jail, right? So sometimes you do.
Yeah, and this is a consequence of that.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I mean. Like, that takes a lot of time. But I think it's the best thing that we do as a family, where we're really, truly explaining. There's no such thing as like, because I said so. There's always a reason. And we're fallible too. We've explained things to our kids where they've already at this young age been like, well, what about this? Have you thought about that? And I'm like, actually, no, I didn't think about that. I guess we won't go there today. Right. So that was a very long-winded explanation, but that's how we think about it. And I think we're relatively consistent with that. Congrats.
No, that's great. I also, as a sidebar, sense a lot of Deutsch and Popper in your approach to education and life in general.
Yes.
Zooming out a bit, and maybe this connects nicely to your opinions about your own children's education, but also what you're trying to do with Moonrisers. We are in the course of human history. We're at this interesting stage where we're kind of at the bottom of this hockey stick. The future is becoming more and more unpredictable, uncertain. And so the skill sets that you now have to have, or the skills you have to have to navigate this uncertain future, are maybe different than they have been for the majority of human history, where things were pretty static and linear.
Yeah.
What is the meta skill, in your opinion, underpinning this approach to and navigation of the future? And then maybe secondarily, what are the other skills that you think supplement that?
So I've heard this argument a lot. I think the base argument is things are changing quicker. Like, as a species, we're making faster progress. So there's higher stock in being creative and adaptive and that sort of thing, right? Is that right?
Like, the first part is where I'd start. Yeah. The change is moving more quickly, and so what are the meta skills? I didn't want to hint at or point to something like creativity. I'll let you fill in the blank there.
Okay, sure. Okay. So the first thing I'll say is, you know, if you had been exceptionally creative or had these very impressive skills, if you had been a Nikola Tesla in 1905, like, you're going to look more like a J.D. Rockefeller, I think, in that world, right? Like, you're going to stand out because there are fewer of you. So the outcome of being that way and having those skills back then has a higher variance compared to normal society than it does today. So back then, the skills were technically, from a relative perspective, more valuable to be that way back then. Today, it's valuable in the sense that if you don't have those skills, you're likely to get behind, right? There's a lot more opportunity now. So, you know, maybe there's like more chances for you just to like kind of live a normal life or whatever than there used to be. But you're definitely not going to be like among the most successful people, let's say, right? So if you want to be among the most successful people, or in the realm of like doing independent work, then those sorts of skills are needed today, right? Whereas, you know, back then, maybe you could have still been like a shoe cobbler or something like that. You could have expressed your creativity that way. Okay. Sorry, I always question the fundamental layer of things. So,
no, that's great.
Yeah. So, I think, is the question about like what those skills are? Like, what's the meta skill now?
Yeah, in your opinion, and we could reframe the question as, and we would have to define all these variables. So it depends on how far up the re-questioning stack you want to go.
Yeah.
In your opinion of what a successful life and future look like, what is the meta skill and what are the other kind of supporting or ancillary skills to achieve that success?
Okay, great. I would have to say it's the ability to create value. I mean, right now, the best explanation we have for economic theory is still capitalism. And capitalism is essentially, you know, what it really boils down to is being able to create value. Right? And so the ability to create value is dependent on a lot of things. But I guess, you know, first and foremost, it's, you know, doing something useful for other people. So being useful is probably the ultimate meta value, but you can't really go to school for being useful, or mm-hmm. or you can't really, like, you know, just say to yourself, I'm going to be useful, and then read a book on usefulness and go and do it. Right. So I guess deeper than being useful is figuring out what is most likely to be useful. And what degree of value do you want to create to consider yourself successful? So some people want to be useful and be a nurse, or they want to be a plumber. And those things, like, have kind of relatively known inputs and outputs, right? Like, you're going to go to trade school, or you're going to do an apprenticeship as a plumber, and you're going to come out and you'll have a career as a plumber. Maybe you'll start your own plumbing business. You're never going to be Elon Musk in that scenario. But if that's what you want to do, then the meta skill is just the ability to know that that's what you want to do, which is actually also kind of thwarted by the current education system. If the goal is to maximize the individual potential of any one human being, then I would still say that it's probably entrepreneurship. The ability to look at the world, and this is basically what a scientist or a really good artist does, is too. The ability to look at the world and see a problem that you or other people have that is unsolved, and obsess about it until you think of a better thing to add to the world that solves that problem. That is essentially what being a founder is identifying a problem, noticing the gap, and closing the gap with a better explanation, right? And just sticking to it along the way. There's probably like a million skills involved with being a good founder. But I think that one, where, like, the thing that I focus on the most with my kids when we're just like going about normal life, is I'll point to something and I'll say, you see, like, he'll say, I really like that building over there. And I'll say something like, did you know that building didn't exist 20 years ago? That building was something that was in the mind of the person who created that building, right? And there were a million buildings that they didn't build, and they chose to build that one. There were a lot of decisions that went into that. Why do you think they made those decisions? Like, what would you do differently? Right. And we just have lots and lots of those kind of conversations all the time, probably to the point that it annoys them. But I've started to hear my son say these things back to me, and it's really rewarding.
This is the reverse of a kid asking why 50 times and annoying their parent. It's the parent getting them to ask why.
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned usefulness, or the ability to add value, as that first thing.
Yep.
And I think this ties in neatly with kind of the origin story of Moonrise, which was you were looking at doing a future of work startup. Through conversations and research, you realized that majority of people, I think the stat is like only 13% of people, find their work meaningful. So there's a clear gap in opportunity here between value creation and usefulness. Opportunity versus what's realized. Why is it that you think people feel, to put it bluntly, useless in their work? And how do we allow or help more people to find meaning and usefulness in their work?
Yeah. I thought about this a lot, obviously, like starting a company that I almost like ended up making my life's work and then pivoting. So when I talk to people about why they're bummed out at work, and I really figure out like, or try to figure out what's going on there, it's ultimately because they feel like they could die and be replaced the next day. So if you go and talk to pretty much anybody, like if they're like, ah, work sucks. Like, yeah, if you really dig into that, it's kind of like they're not useless because they are adding value, but they are an interchangeable part in a machine where they can be replaced if something happens, or like people leave their jobs all the time and somebody else takes that role, right? There are people that still find their work meaningful in the context where if they quit or die, they can be replaced. Like obviously, like pretty much everybody except for, like it'd be pretty hard to replace Elon, right? But you know, there's lots of people still in roles where if they died or retired or whatever, they could be replaced, right? But what you want is to, in those cases, uniquely contribute something that cannot be replaced. So maybe the job to be done could be done, but the way in which you do it cannot be replaced. Or the spin that you add on it. So teachers can find their work really meaningful because they have relationships with students over time, or things that they've done for their students that cannot be replaced, right? They encourage them to start a company and then they went on to, like, you know, be a founder or something like that, right? But I would say like replaceability is essentially like they're feeling like cogs in a machine and they want to do something that they uniquely can do. This is why people, I think, find having kids meaningful. Like, you uniquely created something that nobody else created and that can't be replaced. And only,
right.
Right? Founders kind of have this feeling through the companies that they start. Artists have this feeling through the paintings that, and, you know, sculptures that they make. Filmmakers with their art. Whenever you create something that only you can create that captures a little bit of your soul, I think that's like the essence of true meaning.
Yeah.
And the opposite of that is just, you know, getting plugged in somewhere.
That's deep. How do we, understanding that there are a number of roles in society that just need to be filled for things to operate and run smoothly, and to your point, you can plug into a particular role but add your own flair or spin on it, but most people clearly aren't seeing or interpreting that opportunity the same way. So yeah, either how do we allow or help more people to see the opportunity, the latitude within their roles that just somebody has to fill, or help them find the areas where they can add more unique value?
Yeah. Paul Graham has a lot of really good essays about meaningful work that I think everybody should read. There's one called How to Do Great Work that I think is yeah, excellent.
That I think that one has been mentioned on every podcast episode here.
Oh, yeah?
Since it came out. Yeah.
It's probably the best thing I've ever read about meaningful work. It's really good. So I think your question was essentially like, how does this problem get solved given that people still need to work and there's still roles to be filled, right? This is a bit like the question of like how to replace or, you know, fix the education system, right? It would be a bad scenario if somebody snapped their fingers and public education just went under entirely tomorrow, right? So what you want is like an evolutionary procedure to the better thing, right? I've had several, like I haven't been a founder my whole life. I became a founder when I was 27, and I had several jobs before that that helped me figure out what I want to work on because I had a lot of time to think about it. And I kind of rebelled against the bad feelings to figure out like what it was that I didn't like and did like doing. The reason I mentioned Paul's essay is because if you can't really, I think you can know, but it's very rare to just know what you want to do. Like, I use this example sometimes, but Derek Jeter knew he wanted to be the shortstop for the New York Yankees when he was like 11 years old, right? That's exceptionally rare. Most people just try a bunch of stuff and through a process of self-reflection, figure out what they really like working on, which I usually describe as like, you know, you lose track of time or you enter a flow state or you find yourself doing it even when you don't have to do it, that sort of thing, right? You figure out if you are earnest and you care about this stuff, you figure out the things that you like to do and you figure out the things that you don't like to do. You figure out the people that you like working with and the people you don't like working with. And you kind of iterate your way through to better things, ideally. That's how it works. I believe that every single person has within them the capacity to change the world like Elon Musk. And that's not something that most people agree with. But if you take Deutsche and Popper seriously, and you rightly pointed that out, that that's like the foundation of my worldview. I think that's like, I don't entirely agree with every single thing ever said by those people. But that's the closest thing that I have to like a foundational worldview that's not my own. I mean, if you take what they say seriously about humans and, you know, our infinite potential, then you realize that what Elon has in him that other people that aren't him don't have is just like better explanations about like how to operate, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people will choose not to do that. A lot of people will choose not to be like to choose to be Elon basically means to love humanity more than an individual human, including yourself within your life. Right. And so a lot of people get to that point and they're just like, okay, that's not what I want to do. But, you know, in theory, if I wanted to run 10 companies, then I could get divorced and never see my kids again and just go and start 8 companies that change the world. I believe I could do that. I just don't want to.
Right. Digging in a little bit more to Moonrise, getting more into the weeds. Why did you choose to start with an in-person physical space when there's so much more leverage and distribution with things you can do digitally? Obviously, there's a trade-off there between impact, I think. But why did you feel it was important to start with a physical and local space?
Yeah, this one's easy to answer. The other ones have been like really long-winded. So the really quick answer is because it's the only way you can fix the education system and build a new one, right? Like the foundational theory of Moonrise is that parents need a place to drop off their kids so that they can work and have some time to have a break. And kids need a space that's their own too, that's away from their parents where they can learn and make friends, right? It just so happens that the only place they can really do that is called a school, which comes bundled with a curriculum. And if you give them a different place that does not have a bundled curriculum that's designed for well-being and all the other stuff we talked about, then I think those are the bones coupled with the internet that build a new education system. That's the short, quick answer. We can dive in more if you want, but I know my other ones have been long.
No, that's adequate. Even if that is what's necessary for revolutionizing or reimagining education, the venture level businesses in the education space, particularly in the physical education space, don't have a great track record. There's a number of people working on this at the moment that you and I are familiar with or have been working on this in recent history. Why do you feel like Moonrise is different from a business perspective? Why are you well positioned and poised to innovate and disrupt in a kind of profitable way?
Sure. I think this ties into meaningful work, but people are not specific enough and honest with themselves enough about the problem that they're trying to solve. So, let's start with the idea about like, you know, digital being more scalable and profitable and that sort of thing, right? A lot of people that get into being a founder in general, first are trying to solve the problem of how can I be a founder, right? Like what can I do to call myself an entrepreneur, right? And then people try to solve the problem after that when they say, okay, I don't really like want to start a plumbing company. Like, that's not really what I think of as being a founder. Like, what does that mean? Then they're like, oh, I think I should be one of those founders that should get like a bunch of venture capital dollars, right? And so they're like, okay, that means I have to do software. And then they kind of go down that rabbit hole. And the problem that they're actually trying to solve deep down is being a founder with something that they don't hate doing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's varying degrees of that. Like, there's founders who just want to be like a founder and they start something that they don't really care about that works because it's a good idea. And sometimes like it still is a Darwinian system where those ideas can still work if they're right, even if their founders are not doing it for like, you know, the deepest reasons. And then there's all the way up to, you know, people that it's their life's mission to do it. Right. But I mean, For me, the reason to start Moonrise had nothing to do with being a venture-backed founder and had everything to do with fixing the education. Now, if you're trying to fix the education system, you can't die. Your company cannot die if you're serious about that. So what that does is you have to solve the problem of being profitable. And that causes you to think a lot about like what that means and how to structure a business. Like a business is at its bones outside of its mission and its product. It's a model, right? Like it has to like make more money than it spends, right? It's really baffling to me that people don't spend more time thinking about their models. I've spent more time thinking about the model than just about anything. And it's not obvious because we haven't really changed it that much. But one of the reasons for that is I spent so much time before I launched it thinking about it. So, you know, there still is a ramp up. Like I even though I planned for everything, like I was wrong about a couple things in the first year and I didn't plan enough for ramp and we spent more on getting it launched than I thought we would. So there was a time where Moonrise almost died last year. We were about 14 days away from going under. Wow. And had to turn the ship around and figure some stuff out. But that's the honest answer is that like I really fundamentally mostly care, sometimes to the detriment of my personal life, about fixing the education system. And that means building a sustainable company regardless of where the investment dollars come from. We do have venture funding. Yeah. Did you also ask yet about like the fallbacks of some of the other players yet in, or was the question just about like why I chose?
No, it was just about you, but I'm curious to hear if you have a take on it, if the answer is other than there wasn't an incentive alignment or value and interest alignment between the founder and the problem they were trying to solve, like there is with you. What were the other reasons that these other companies had failed that you're able to incorporate lessons from, or other founders aspiring to start companies in the space should be aware of?
Sure. A lot of this gets into like startup theory. So there was a really big famous thing called Alt School that raised, I want to say they raised like $300 million or something like that. It was a lot of money. Don't remember the exact amount, but it was hundreds of good founders. I think they came from Google, that sort of thing. The idea was basically to, you know, have a physical space, but move all the curriculum online, right? One of the problems with that is that you're still competing. Like if you're within the world of school, it is basically like blue ocean theory, and you are in a red ocean of competition with all the other possible, you know, schools to send your kids to, right? So even Alt School with its like, you know, different spaces and its, you know, fancy online curriculum, there still is like kind of disruption theory and zero to one theory and all that kind of stuff that gets into, you know, products and all that stuff. And is Alt School or was Alt School 10 times better than another school that costs, you know, $30,000 a year to send your kids to? And the answer is it's honestly worse. Because Alt School did not have a lot of the perks that came with a regular school. Like, you know, to my knowledge, they didn't have sports or clubs or field trips or anything like that. So they were saying, okay, the curriculum is better here and you get more flexibility as a parent, right? So then the question is like, okay, how many parents value that advantage and how advantageous is it compared to other options? And it wasn't advantageous right. enough to get enough people to move to that future, right? Online options are a little different. They do have the scale. So something like Khan Academy is interesting, but since it's a nonprofit, they have to kind of like, you know, raise their dollars to stay alive. And, you know, they've done a really good job staying alive. You know, I would say the biggest pain point for the other ones is that they're not primary learning, it's supplementary learning. And so then you get into both time considerations, like kids are increasingly busy with school. So they have their normal schoolwork, then they have sports, then they have aftercare, then they have homework. So you're kind of competing with time, and then you're still in a red ocean with all the other things that they could be learning online, many of which are free, like information wants to be free online. So a lot of people blame this on parents not wanting to spend money on education. I think it's closer to the first theory that I mentioned, where there's just like lots of options that want to be free and an increasingly small amount of free time that kids have.
part of the reason I asked about the business and business model piece is because when comparing the price point of Moonrise to public education expenditure, I think lots of people would be surprised. Right now, it's not you do call it an unlimited plan. I think the price point is $250 a month, but it's not truly unlimited in that you encourage people to only come like 1 to 3 times a week, I believe.
Yep.
But even if you extrapolated that and said, we do want to make this full-time, accessible full-time, it would probably still be on the order of like a third as expensive as what New York public schools are paying for.
Yep.
I'm sure you know this more specific numbers, yep. But how... maybe this loops back to our very first conversation, but how do you explain that discrepancy? Is it all that bureaucracy and all these not needed additional layers that have been built into the existing system over time?
Yes. Short answer is yes. So my first company was called 10 Rocket. And the realization there was that, you know, if you wanted to get an app built by an agency, they were going to charge you like $100,000 to $150,000 and take 6 months to build an app. If you want to figure out why that is, it's because every time you start a project with an agency, they give you a designer, a developer, a project manager, an account team, and they have to send lots of emails back and forth with each other while also servicing Coca-Cola, not just your app, right? And all those people are all on payroll, they have benefits, they have like ebbs and flows in their model and their time where they have to like overcome it. When they get work, they have to charge more for work. And so the answer to how you solve that problem is basically to like cut all that, as much of that stuff in the middle. If you can just cut it to development time, you can cut the expense down by about, you know, 10 times. That's what it really comes down to, right? Actually a little bit more than 10. That's essentially what happens with homeschool, right? Like, think about, like, if you think about the cost comparison of homeschooling to a kid going through Chicago public schools, like, what's crazy is that the homeschooler, it's not even a question that they're getting a better education, right? But they're also getting, like, childcare that's built into their house, assuming the parent doesn't have to, you know, work for the hours when they're at their house. Like, it's already a fixed asset that's there. The parent is using pretty inexpensive tools, both online and, you know, just curriculum that they can buy on Amazon and that sort of thing. Parents don't even have to be trained at homeschooling to just wipe the floor with professionals like that go to get master's degrees and do continuing education. And it's, you know, without Moonrise in that picture, it still is way, way, way cheaper, like by a similar order of magnitude, like 10 to 20 times cheaper. And you also get a more effective system for them learning and developing as well. So that's kind of like the spectrum is, you know, on the worst of it, you get like Chicago public schools in terms of cost per pupil. And then you get down to homeschooling, which is, you know, essentially like it's not free because you have fixed costs, but it's not much added cost, right? And so that's the spectrum that Moonrise is playing with.
Right.
And so, you know, if you go and talk to a homeschooler about what they need, a homeschooler, and by the way, we're talking about today, not like as the market evolves, right? But homeschooling by default means that you are choosing not to have any childcare at all, right? Like you're going to have them at home, right? So when Moonrise comes to the table and says, here's a little bit of childcare plus all the other things that you liked about school that you no longer get, like that's a really compelling value proposition, right? It's not really that dependent at the end of the day on childcare because you're losing out on all the other stuff too, right? So, I guess that's a way of saying that like the utilization doesn't necessarily matter as much when you're comparing utilization to zero, right? Mm. If Moonrise didn't exist, a lot of these people would still homeschool today. And so when you give them something, like they're able to make what they're already doing better, but they're not dependent on the most extensive part, which is the physical space being there for childcare.
That's an excellent point. You've almost taken a 180 approach from alt school where they unbundled and tried to do a partial rebundle with an emphasis on curriculum. And you've unbundled and made the emphasis not on curriculum and more on space and kind of flexible usage.
Yes. Yeah, it's really weird to focus on curriculum, in my opinion. I always call it competing with the internet. Right? Like information wants to be free. And, even within the context of like teaching you how to fix the carburetor in your specific car, there are probably 100 different things at least vying for your attention for that one niche thing online, and everybody's competing to try to make the best version, right? So I'm not saying online learning is perfect. There's still a lot of work to be done if you're homeschooling to bundle those things in compelling ways, you know, that makes sense for your kid. But even in that sense, like, you're more like a doctor where the doctor says, hey, try this medication and this way of fixing your leg. And then you go back to the doctor a month later and they're like, oh, that didn't work. Try this thing instead. Like, in school, there's no doctor and there's no, like, you know, there's no ongoing evaluation. It's like, here's how we fix legs. Hope it works for you.
That's a great point. Yeah, I like that analogy. Maybe two or three more questions. Design and aesthetics are core to your reimagination of education, which is not, I think, even in consideration when it comes to the traditional school. Why are design and beauty so important to you? And maybe more specifically or tactically, what is the aesthetic you're trying to go for that you think is most conducive to learning?
I wish I had a better answer for this. You know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, some people are just like naturally inclined and they find themselves doing things. They don't really have a great explanation. For whatever reason, I found out pretty late. I would say, like, I found out that I really was into design and beauty, like, when I started designing the apps that came through our doors at 10 Rocket. Like, I didn't want to hire designers, and we were trying to, like, you know, get an app built in 10 days. And I was already scoping it, but the developer, you know, since they were builders, they didn't really want to get involved with the design of it. And that process was too variable. So I had to get, like, really good at just, like, designing different UIs really quickly. And it always felt like play to me. It was just really, really fun. So, you know, because I'm such a, I guess, analytical guy, I started, like, wondering why, like, you know, I'd still be, like, non-coerced to stay up until 1 o'clock in the morning, like, working on a client's design, right? I mean, if I try to, like, figure it out, I think it's something like that I believe in objective beauty, and that I believe beauty makes the world better and is itself a form of knowledge. Like, I'm very much, like, a sensory person. So my wife jokes with me all the time. If there's, like, a loud noise going on somewhere in the other room, or if we're at a restaurant and somebody's being really noisy, like, it really bothers me. I have kind of, like, sensitive ears and sensitive eyes, and I think a lot about all kinds of senses. And so if somebody's going to come and use something that I built, I want that to be as pleasing to their senses as possible, because that's how we process the world, right? Like, you know, you want a pleasing sound when you walk in the door. You want it to smell good. You want it to look nice. And we know intuitively that this is a spectrum. Like, everybody takes, like, wedding photos in front of churches and not, like, concrete walls, right? So I do believe that there's a spectrum. And if there's any spectrum that we know about and kind of agree to, then I'm trying to make progress and get better, right? So I want to push it further down the better spectrum. And it's just another form of progress. So that's me trying to, like, analyze what's actually going on. But really, it just kind of is a almost like a sense that just lives in me. Like, I just want things to be pleasing and beautiful.
Yeah, it's more intuitive. We talked about this a little bit earlier when we spoke about the kind of accelerating rate of change and technological advancement. Moonrise is, although, again, you aren't opinionated about the curriculum, you're pretty progressive in your allowance of, or, like, procurement of technology.
Sure.
On one hand, totally understandable. It's happening whether or not people like it, get used to it, understand how to leverage the technology. But on the other, I think there are downsides to technology, of course. How are you choosing where to kind of bow to and incorporate technology versus lean towards maybe more traditional or Lindy, quote unquote, ways of living?
Sure. So, like, downsides to technology, I guess if you're, like, a student of technology, you realize that, you know, any attempt at progress is always met by people who abuse it. It's pretty rare to find a technology that in itself is morally flawed or something like that, right? And there's disagreeing takes on this. I think there's somebody, I think her name is Liv Bory, and she either tweeted something that she wrote or somebody else wrote, but like that software and hardware can have like embedded moral values, like Facebook can have embedded moral values. I think in that sense, like software is a little different than a device. Like software can have embedded moral values because you can like design a game around like a like an outcome. So usually when I'm talking about technology, I'm putting the software aside, and you know, usually this comes up in the frame of like my position on devices and that sort of thing, right? So to me, a device is a blank canvas through which information is conveyed in various ways. And a book is like that too, right? Like a book is just a like a bound set of paper, right? And you can write Mein Kampf in that book, or you can write the beginning infinity in that, right? But to be anti-book would be irrational and kind of outrageous, right? I think that's like where the device consideration is at today in terms of like popular discourse, is like people are talking about books instead of like authors and the things that they're writing. And so my take like is very pro device because it is a better vehicle through which information is conveyed, better in the sense that it has higher bandwidth for knowledge, right? Like a video contains more knowledge usually than a piece of text, especially for children when they can't read. Right. So it's really odd that this comes down to like devices like that children can't use, because if they don't know how to read yet, like it's better that they consume information and learn about the world than not. Right. And so like my opinions of where it goes astray are when either the purveyors of software or like the people who create content have wrong values. And unfortunately, that is a downside of using devices, is that kids and other people can just access things that can be harmful to them online. So to the best of our abilities, so as parents, like, you know, we have parental settings that prevent, you know, really bad websites. In terms of screen time, it's not that we think that they are like in a bad position if they spend all day doing cool things on a screen. It's that they are sometimes not doing other things that they would choose to do if they weren't sucked into that, which I guess like even that, like I'm in terms of Deutschians, like that's I'm a little bit of a radical in that sense that we still have screen time limits, right? But again, that goes into our explanation with our own kids and stuff, where we say, okay, like here's why we do that. It's because, you know, you like spending time outside and it can be hard because these things are addicting and they're designed to be addicting. Let's talk about that, that sort of thing. And then at Moonrise, you know, we again, like I'm not their parents, so we encourage parents to figure out what their own philosophy is, and we try to make that an informed decision where we share information with them. And if they want device limits, then they can put those into their iPads. With our own devices at Moonrise, we limit them to, you know, essentially the various experiences that we host. That just like allows us to not get into a lot of these considerations. Like if they want device time for their kids, they can let them come with them. If not, they just don't let them come with them, and that's fine. I think that covers pretty much everything. Is there anything about the text that you that I didn't cover that you want to?
No, I think it's a good delineation between hardware or the vehicle for information delivery. I think where things start to get trickier, to your point, is where you start discussing particular pieces of content or websites. Some of those folks would argue are objectively bad for children. Others, you start to get into a gray area, and that's where maybe as a provider of a space in partnership with the parents, you have to figure out what do we think is best for the student. So maybe there's no kind of global mandate here that we should be pushing for, even though I think I saw recently, I think her tagline or like claim to fame on Twitter is the world's strictest superintendent. I think she's in the UK. She had a tweet go viral recently about how much homework students should be doing. And she was pushing for pushing out of mobile devices in the classroom or on school campuses at all. And so it's just interesting to see the kind of spectrum of opinions still that people have, because I'm certainly not in that boat.
I got into an argument with somebody about this. It was either yesterday or the day before, who was a public school teacher, about this stuff. And, you know, he was kind of coming from the perspective that, like, in school, kids are on their phones a lot, right? And that they're not using it for schoolwork or learning and that sort of thing. And I kind of flipped the conversation, you know, to where, imagine you weren't a teacher and instead you had to be a student for a day. Like, you're going from class to class, you're being told where to sit and what to learn. And then you finally have some time on your device. Like, are you going to use it to do homework or watch, like, you know, educational videos on YouTube? Right. Are you going to go on social media? And then I was like, does that mean that you lack tech discipline or you lack freedom? Right. Like, that's kind of where I'm coming from with it.
Yeah. And that the learning environment that they have access to isn't better than the entertainment or learning that they have available on their device.
Yes.
If you want people to be using devices less, create a more compelling environment for them to participate in.
Absolutely. And again, like, the enemy is not the device, right? So, like, we can get into, like, what software, you know, is good for people. Oddly enough, like, again, like, this gets into, like, just kids are human. Like, most software that's bad for kids is bad for adults too, right? In fact, I find it hard to think of a software that's bad for kids but isn't bad for adults, right? And you don't really hear adults saying we should limit adult screen time or access to screen.
Right.
Like, they can self-limit those things, right? But the conversation is usually, like, around kids and what kids should be allowed to do, not, like, banning, you know, adults from using things.
Yeah, goes back to taking kids seriously.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, in closing, I always ask the same final question, which is, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with either to think about or act on?
Nobody's ever asked me that before. That's really interesting. What's one question that I would leave you to ponder?
Or act on?
Yeah. I think my driving question at my core is, what are the set of actions I can take to live the best possible life? Most of what I do is designed kind of maybe top of mind and maybe subconsciously around answering that question. So thinking about what it means for you to live the best possible life opens up a lot of philosophy and self-reflection and that sort of thing. So, and invariably, like, even when I answer that question today, there's usually gaps, right? And the question changes over time. So asking yourself that often will point out ways that you are doing things kind of on autopilot or just without really thinking about it that are against what future you wants current you to do. So
how do you know where to draw the line and obsessively asking yourself that question and falling into the cycle of kind of analysis paralysis? At the end of the day, we're on this treadmill. Life is moving by. It's good to ask yourself this question periodically, but doing it too much could drive you insane.
I very rarely do it consciously, where I sit down. Like, I'm anti-prison in almost every, like, not in the literal sense, like, prisons are fine, but people build prisons of their own making all the time, right? Even people that are like, oh, you should have a daily journaling practice or something like that. And every day you should write this question down in your notebook, or you should do morning pages or something like that. Like, these end up becoming like self-inflicted prisons for people, and life can become mechanized in that way. For me, this is like, if you had to have kind of like a secret philosophy that's driving action, that's like under the surface and not really at your conscious awareness, like, ideally, this is, if you had one question, you'd be answering this, because you only have, you know, your one life and you want to live as well as possible. So it's really one of those things where if you notice, like, yourself in any, like, state of suffering or discontent, it'll come up then where I'm like, okay, that's information. Like, that problem just hit me. I noticed that I'm suffering. I noticed that I snapped at my child. Like, why did I do that? And then I'll dig into that and be like, okay, like, am I taking the set of actions that's causing me to live the best life, right? Maybe I should like reevaluate that one thing so that I can live a better life, right? Most people, the reason I brought up that one question is because most people don't do that really at all.
No.
At least in my experience, they don't. There's some people who, where the lights are on and they're self-reflective and that sort of thing. There's some quote about like the unexamined life is not worth living. And this is just a way, I think, to like actually examine life. And some people who hear this question may be doing it for the first time.
Chris, this was awesome. A ton of fun. Thank you so much. And looking forward to following along with you in Moonrise.
My pleasure. Thanks, Spencer.